Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO at Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print in the March-April issue. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the ninth in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Bruce Schneier. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Bruce is the founder and CTO of Counterpain, and he's hands down the world's foremost security guru. In fact, you might call him the Uber guru of security. He's the author of 8 best-selling books, including Secrets and Lies, Beyond Fear, and Applied Cryptography. Bruce is also the editor and chief curmudgeon of the Cryptogram mailing list, which has about 120,000 subscribers and has been going for 7 years. He's a self-described media slut, a restaurant reviewer of great renown for the Minneapolis Star, along with his wife, Karen Cooper. And let's spend some time with Bruce. Off we go. So your book, Applied Cryptography, certainly got you on the security map, including the associated Dr. Dobbs articles. But my question is, how did you get started in computer security after finishing school at American?
Well, security, I think, is something you're born with. I think it's a way of looking at the world. It's a way of looking at systems and seeing how they break. I think security people, when they go about their day and they walk into stores, they see the cameras, they go to vote and they look at the security, they walk through an airport. So I think there's a mentality of security that some people just have. It's the way they look at the world. I've always been interested in cryptography ever since I was a kid and have been studying it off and on.
Did you get one of those little decoder rings from
Long John? No, I had all the decoder rings, and they were the kids' books. And my first job out of college was for Department of Defense in security and cryptography and cryptographic systems. So, and that I got because I had a physics degree and not a double E degree or a computer degree.
I see.
And back then...
So that was when you just came out of Rochester.
Right. And this is the mid-80s. The government really couldn't pay competitive salaries for engineers. So they never really got engineers. But a physicist who couldn't get an engineering job in industry, I was able to sort of, you know, squeeze my resume sideways and fit their requirements. So I dropped into working for DOD, you know, on some of these issues. And that's where I got my master's, and then, you know, a couple of jobs later, including AT&T Bell Labs, and I was unemployed. There was a layoff. And when a company like Bell Labs gives you a layoff, they actually give you a big chunk of money and say, you know, don't be mad at us, which enabled me to go freelance. And that's when I started writing Dr. Dobbs articles and actually other articles in computer magazines. And that's when I conceived the book and wrote it and published it, and I guess the rest is history.
Yep. It's funny how that all happens. So Ross Anderson points out, in sort of a big picture trend way, that security is transitioning from guns, dogs, and concrete to technology people. And one question that brings to mind is, do the future security people of the world need to be technologists, do you think?
I think security is all about technology. There are definitely fundamental social and economic issues. There are ways of looking at the world that let you see the big picture, to see how attacks work, how defenses work, what sorts of countermeasures there are. But once you get past that broad picture and the broad analysis, it's all about technology. And whether you're looking at home security or computer security or airport security, you're looking at technology and how technologies work, how they fail. The details of technologies are vital. So while you need the big picture, non-technological perspective, you need to apply that into the technologies because everything now is technological.
Do you sort of agree with the view that we're in some sort of transition from physical security, guns, dogs, and concrete, to more technology?
You know,
are we done? Is it a real thing? What do you think?
You know, we'll never be done with physical security. As long as there are physical threats, we'll need physical security. But even physical security has more of a technological component. So alarm systems are more often now computer alarm systems. They might use the internet to communicate with each other and with some kind of base station. So, and I'd never think we're going to get rid of walls or fences. I mean, you know, look at something like an airport, which has a lot of technology there, but you need the basic physical security. So I think we're not seeing a shift from A to B, but a combination of A and B.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking more of a shift in personnel than stuff itself.
Definitely a shift in personnel.
So if you look at the big banks in New York, you know, the person who's now in charge of security is no longer guy who has a bunch of keys and thinks so much about physical security. It's more a chief risk officer who maybe gets kept up at night because of Sarbanes-Oxley or something like that.
And I think this is the shift in thinking. I mean, this is what I try to write in Beyond Fear, that security used to be about guards, about fences, mm-hmm. about alarm systems. These days, security is much more about systems. Mm-hmm. So you have an entire system of building security, or airport security, or computer security.
Sure.
And people who think systemically understand how these things work much more than people who come out of the old school police-like or, you know, guard service-like security mentality.
Yeah.
So that I definitely agree with. I think there is a shift there. And I think it's an important one. I think a lot of the things we see about security that make no sense are because they come from people who aren't thinking systemically,
yeah.
and who aren't looking at the big picture.
So you and others have talked a lot about the intersection of economics and security as an interesting and fertile ground. How do you think the academic work in this subfield, this economics meets security subfield, will impact commercial security, and when do you think that'll happen?
I think it already is, because a lot of what economics is doing today is explaining things that are happening commercially. You know, why isn't this product selling? Why did this product beat that product? Why aren't users doing the thing we think they're doing? And often there are economic explanations for that. When you look at the field of economics and security, there are sort of two basic types of papers we see. One is a paper that tries to explain the real world. You know, here's what we're seeing out there, and here's why I think it happens, which involves producing some kind of economic model that will mirror the real world. And the other one is more empirical, to run tests and experiments and then try to infer a model from those. And there's convergence, there's divergence, there's a lot of things going on right now in the field. It's still very, very new.
Mm-hmm.
But what it'll do is it'll give product vendors, technologists, even researchers, a better feel for the sorts of things that are likely to happen once a security technology leaves the lab and gets in the hands of users. So I think what it'll do is it'll help vendors market their products, sell their products, even build their products in a way that users will use them and not ignore them.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's probably because at the bottom of it, if you think about economics, you're thinking about risk management and trying to make, you know, trying to manage your risks appropriately given the current resource pile. And,
right.
And I think the shift towards thinking security as a risk management game has been well underway for a long time.
Right, and it's something that people who are successful at it knew, right? People in the banks got it immediately.
Oh, absolutely.
People in the credit card industry have known this for decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's really only us in the computer field that got so tied up in the technology that we forgot the big social economic picture. And that, to me, is the real convergence that's happening now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember being taught that lesson myself in around 1997 by the guys at Visa when actually, we were all working for Lance Johnson at the time. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember working for Lance also and learning a lot about how a real company approaches security.
Yeah.
That you know, a solution that costs more than the problem you're solving is a useless solution.
Yeah.
That it's just a matter of figuring out what the cheapest alternative is.
So
and sometimes ignoring the problem is cheaper.
So technology is certainly agnostic when it comes to security. Although some people believe for no apparent reason that maybe technology is either all good or all evil, but it's just as likely to be used for evil as it is to be used for good. Let's talk about some upcoming interesting technologies and maybe talk about the benefits and potential dangers, starting with everybody's favorite bugaboo, which is digital rights management.
Yeah, it's interesting. What technology does in general is it increases leverage. So it'll make something cheaper or easier. And it's true for attack technologies, right? Think of bigger bombs or even weapons of mass destruction. It's true for defensive technologies, right? Think cameras. As these things become automated and cheaper and smaller, it gives the person using them more leverage. So when you look at digital rights management, it's a technology that basically tries to automate the detection of copying. And you know, that's why it could be successful. And you know, therein are also the reasons we in some of the communities are so fearful of it or we dislike it so much, that it automates a process. And that's where you get the good and evil. It depends if you like what's being automated or not.
Yeah, right. Have you read some of Felton's stuff on Freedom to Tinker about what he calls PRM?
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And so what's happening is there has been this notion of fair use, these rights that we have when we get media, and the right of a book to read it where we want and how we want, to lend it to somebody, to write critiques of the book and excerpt pieces. There are these bunches of things that fall under fair use. There's a movement that says that fair use doesn't actually exist, mm-hmm. that fair use was only there because you couldn't control it. So it was there because you didn't have the leverage.
An accident of technological
inefficiency. Right. It was an accident of technological inefficiency. And now that we have the efficiency, we can control these fair uses. You know, to me, digital rights management, in the end, is not going to work. And you see it now because you see the huge legal infrastructure that has to support the technologies. The technologies don't work in themselves. The only reason they are working as they are is because the media companies spend a lot of time either jiggering the laws a certain way or prosecuting in very predatory ways. Right? The technology itself is not going to solve that problem. Right? I think, to me, that's the sort of interesting part of DRM.
Right.
Eventually, you know, we're going to realize that making digital files not copyable is kind of like making water not wet. and new business models will emerge that will take advantage of the natural flow of the technology, that won't try to make money copying the each. I wrote papers on this many years ago, mm-hmm. looking at sort of different economic models. And the obvious one is the television model. When television was invented, it was beamed for free into everybody's house. All you had to do was buy a receiver. And the way the industry made money was through product placement, advertisements. Right? That is an economic model that doesn't try to limit access to the media.
And maybe at the time it was too confusing to figure out how to limit access.
But you know, you can imagine them doing it, right? There could be an annual tax on a television, and I believe in the UK there was a television tax for many years.
I kind of like that idea. You know, and I don't let my kids watch TV. It'd be better to just tax
them. I think in the UK it went for public programming, but you know, you can easily imagine other economic models. So, you know, to me, we are losing the ability to control copying the individual units. And that doesn't mean media is dead. Of course not. It just means we need alternative business models. And they're out there. But we have an industry who's hell-bent on keeping the business model they already had.
So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about another thing that's changed radically under the impact of technology, and that's surveillance. You know, video surveillance, you pointed out in an NPR piece, which I liked a lot, how many video cameras there were in Minneapolis, you know, and the fact that you could easily be tracked, and future trends to have GPS enabled inside your cell phone. These sorts of things make surveillance a lot easier. That should be good for security, but what's the deal?
You know, I'll spend an hour talking on this very topic. It's a big deal. It's a big change that technology is bringing.
Yeah.
And again, it's all about leverage. What we're seeing now is something I call wholesale surveillance. I mean, we all know what surveillance looks like. You see it on television. It's follow that car, right? It's listening on that guy's phone calls. Wholesale surveillance is something you only get with technology, and it's follow every car.
Right.
Listening on everybody's conversation.
Well, then you get the chance to sort of hide like a needle in the haystack, I suppose.
You know, you can and you can't, because let's face it, computers are really, really good at needle in a haystack problems. I mean, what does computers excel at? Boring, repetitive tasks. And looking at, you know, 20 billion pieces of hay looking for a needle is ideally suited for a computer.
Good point.
So as computing gets cheaper, the hiding in plain sight becomes less possible. And you have companies, you know, ChoicePoint, that collects all of our data and sorts it on everybody. And you can, so you can be picked out. So when you're looking at surveillance, and what will end up being ubiquitous surveillance, I think we're seeing a huge sea change in how society works. In a very real sense, we are living in a unique time. The cameras are everywhere, and you can still see them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? ID checks happen again and again, and you know they're happening. 10, 15 years, the cameras will be so small you won't notice them. The ID checks will happen automatically, either through an RFID exchange from your wallet to some reader, or possibly through automatic face recognition and a camera, and you won't even know that you're being identified. And we need to look at this not only in terms of security, but in terms of privacy and liberty.
Absolutely.
Because what I'm describing is very much a police state. And while you could argue that, hey, in a police state there's less crime, you know, I don't think any of us would rather live there. There is a price to liberty, and the price of liberty is the possibility of crime. We have to decide if we as a society want to be surveilled all the time, if we want everybody on 100% surveillance. And these are important questions. The answers aren't obvious. It's very nuanced. It, a lot depends on circumstance. But it's debates we need to have, because the technology is moving in that direction. And again, it's all about leverage. Technology gives a surveillance agent much more leverage.
So you've talked about security theater in different venues, especially when it comes to, say, airport security. And I wonder whether there's a link between the security theater problem and what you're just talking about now, with the danger of the police state and surveillance everywhere, and the misuse of security for political gain, say. How are those things related, or are they?
You know, I think there is a relation. It's subtle, but a lot of the security measures that involve ubiquitous surveillance that we've been seeing in a post-9/11 America don't actually give us much security, that they are much more about the appearance of security than actual security. And for those who haven't heard the term, security theater is the name I give to security measures that look good but don't actually do anything. So they are there more for the appearance of security than actual security. And our nation is filled with them. I mean, since 9/11, you know, there are just dozens and dozens of examples. And in a lot of ways, ubiquitous surveillance is like that. Because, you know, you think of it and say, wow, they're going to watch everybody, I'll be safer. But then if you think about it more, societies where that has actually happened have been some of the most repressive regimes on the planet. So it starts out sounding like a decent idea, but actually isn't.
So, so let's switch gears over to Microsoft for a minute. Microsoft has tried very hard to turn things around from a security perspective, especially on the software security front. And the question is, how are they doing? I mean, is the monoculture problem that you guys wrote about still a critical issue? Are we seeing some improvement on Microsoft's behalf, or is that security theater too?
You know, Microsoft takes a lot of flack for everything they do. It's because they're the big guy out there. You know, when you're the monopoly, you can't rely on economic pressure to get a company to move in the right direction. You know, that's why monopolies are bad for society. And Microsoft having basically, you know, a monopoly position in operating systems means that they have to be watched more closely. Right? That being said, Microsoft's made a lot of strides in software security.
It's funny you use that word, the stride model that Mike Howard has.
Yeah, and I think they have. I think they've been making huge strides in producing secure software. It's a big problem with them because they have an enormous amount of legacy code.
Yeah.
So it might take 10, 15 years before a security practice that is known to be good gets into every piece of code just because that's how long it takes to swap out all the legacy code.
Absolutely.
So it's a huge juggernaut, and it's hard to move.
And the market's not going to wait around either. That's clear.
The market's not going to wait around, but the market doesn't have much choice sometimes. You know, the new version of Windows comes out and everyone uses it. If it's delayed a year, there's not a whole lot of shifting to other OSs. There's some, but not enough that makes a difference.
No, Apple's up to 12% now, I think.
Yeah, that's good. And Linux is, I guess, less than that still.
Yep.
But I think they've done a lot. And you read about, I know people in Microsoft who talk about their software security practices in development.
Absolutely.
Think they made huge strides.
Yeah, we did a podcast with Michael Howard not too long ago where he was talking about their secure development lifecycle.
You know, there are trends working against them, though. Because every operating system is bigger and more complex, mm-hmm. there's going to be naturally more problems and more bugs. So that is a countervailing tendency.
Mm-hmm.
They also still have the problem of patching that they haven't yet figured out how to make that good. I think Patch Tuesday has been a huge improvement, and we should be happy about that.
Especially
they have a long
if
way
you're
to
psyched
go.
About, you know, Hack Wednesday.
Yeah, I suppose. But, you know, patching is a hard problem. If you think about it,
oh, yeah, it is.
A patch is because of vulnerability has to be promulgated immediately. I mean, you want it out 12 hours, 24 hours. The faster you get it out, the better it is.
Okay, a non-security question for you. What non-geek book are you currently reading?
Actually, the book I'm reading right now is called The Wisdom of Crowds. And it talks about, basically it's about groupthink. It's about how crowds can be smarter than the individuals in them, how they can be dumber, what the difference is, and how to arrange things so you get the wisdom of crowds instead of the madness or delusion of crowds.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
It's an interesting book, and it does really relate to security, because a lot of things we're talking about involve how people relate to security, how groups relate to security.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, figuring out how to get groups to make better decisions rather than worse decisions, I think is important.
And then another non-security question, what's the best cheap wine you've had lately? And I'm going to have to define cheap for you as less than $10.
You know, I did a wine tasting for Counterpane it was a customer conference. It was earlier this year in Las Vegas. And I produced, I think, 2 dozen wines, a dozen whites and a dozen reds. And they were all under $10.
Yeah,
and they were all interesting and they're all good.
Okay, so
and
name
my
one.
My advice for wines that are reasonably priced is go to the areas of France that aren't trendy. So look for Loire wines, look for Provence wines, look for some of the obscure Southern Rhones, and you're likely to find really good values.
How about South America? Any good stuff down there?
I know less about South America. I know much more about Europe.
Uh-huh.
And Europe tends to make food-friendly wines. And when I look at wine, it's not to drink at a party, it's to drink with a meal.
Yep.
And wines that go better with food are better for me. And you want to go to cultures where wine has been an accompaniment for food for centuries. You know, not a culture that's making wine for an export market or for a resale market. A culture
or
making
titrating
wine.
It on ships on its way across
right.
the ocean.
Right. You want a culture where they make the wine for them.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, this was fun.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The March-April issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine will feature a print version of this interview. In addition, the issue will feature a number of technical articles on malware and rootkits. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Citadel and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.